This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. More than 70 years ago, Eva Schloss and her family made a number of grueling moves to evade and hide from the Nazis. Eventually, they were found and were forced to work at the Auschwitz concentration camp. Eva and her mother survived. But now today, she's here in La Crosse, and she's the keynote speaker at this year's Teaching the Holocaust workshop through Viterbo University. The workshop is celebrating its 10th anniversary, and Eva Schloss is here today to share her story. And Eva, I can't thank you enough for being here. So Eva, you grew up as a member of the Geiringer family, and you were born in Vienna, Austria, if I'm not mistaken. Correct. Can you talk about your childhood and maybe let us know a bit about your family?
It was a very happy childhood. I had an older brother who was a wonderful young man. We really had a very, very close relationship. And we had grandparents, my mother's parents. My mother had a sister. My grandparents had many siblings, so we had a very big extended family. And we were very, very close. And Austria is actually a beautiful country with lakes and mountains. And Vienna as well, a beautiful city with a lot of culture. And my father was a very sporty person, very enterprising. He was one of the first people who had a car in the 30s. As well, I remember when flying became I wouldn't say it was popular, but it started to become something people used to do. We did fly in an aeroplane. I was sick all the time. It was not a really pleasant experience, but I loved everything. And so we were very happy. But all this was shattered when the Nazis entered.
So eventually your family decided then to move to Amsterdam.
My father had a shoe factory, which he had inherited from his parents, and he had connections in the south of the Netherlands.
Okay.
And as soon as the Nazis came in, he went on a, so to say, business trip. And so he went, but, you know, at the time for refugees, there was no accommodation, no help. And so he said, as soon as I have found accommodation and settled, I will send for us. But by the time he was ready, we didn't get an exit visa or an entry visa into Holland. So my mother was desperate to find a way out, and we heard that you could go illegally over the border to Belgium. And once you are there, you could stay. So that is what we did. Which was, of course, very dangerous. If we would have been caught, we might have been shot or picked up, and God knows what might have happened to us.
Do you remember then reuniting with your father and then eventually settling down?
Well, we lived for 1.5 years in Brussels, which was not very pleasant because the Belgians really didn't want any Jews and refugees. And it was really very tough. I didn't speak a word of French, and nobody took any notice of me. I was put in the back of the class, and I had to just try to follow. I lost all my confidence. I became very shy, and I hated to be separated from my father. And so it was really very, very difficult. And in the meantime, Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia and then Poland, and the Second World War broke out. And my father had tried all the time to get a visa for us to Holland. And eventually, in February 1940, we got a visiting visa for 3 months to come to Amsterdam.
And I'm sure that was just thrilling to be able to be reunited again.
Well, that was wonderful, but it was for 3 months.
Sure.
So my father rented a furnished apartment, and after 3 months we would have had to go back to Belgium. But in a way, this was lucky, but it was, of course, terrible. In May, the German army marched into the Netherlands, and there was a very, very short war of just 5 days. The Dutch royal family escaped to England and then later to Canada. And we tried to escape, still to go to the harbor to find a boat to England, but it was too late. And so we were trapped. There was no way out anymore.
And at this time, you're about 10, 11 years old?
Yeah, I was 11 at the time.
I mean, did you feel like you were a typical schoolgirl with these extraneous situations around you? I mean, I don't know how, as a child, you even process what's going on.
Well, in Brussels, I was very unhappy. But in Amsterdam, I got immediately a bicycle. And I really looked Dutch with blonde hair and blue eyes. And the Dutch children and the people in general were very welcoming. And I made many friends right away. Everybody wanted to be my best friend. You know what girls are, little cliques. and they made me feel very welcome. And we had a nice apartment. And I thought things might look up again a bit.
So one of the things that I think makes your story relatable in the grand scheme of the Holocaust is that you, when you moved to Amsterdam, your family actually moved across the street from Anne Frank's family. And I think Anne Frank is that figure that so many of us as a child, we all read that story. That helped us all kind of understand the situation that you all went through.
Well, yeah, I know. well, as I say, Anna and me were the same age. She was actually a month younger than me, but she was actually much more grown up than I was. I was quite a childish child, and she was quite sophisticated in my eyes. She was already more interested in her hairstyles, in clothes, and I was really a tomboy. And
you were very sporty, from what I understand,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, sporty and not sophisticated, really, in that way, like Anne was. And she was not at all shy. She had not experienced any discrimination because her family emigrated in 1933. Otto Frank, he always used to say, when the Nazis came to power, he said, that's not a country where I want to bring up a family. And he was able to get out in time. So Anna didn't experience any anti-Semitism, and she settled down very happily and learned the language easily with 4 years old, and she didn't speak any German anymore. But she introduced herself. She was a very polite little girl, and when she heard I came from Austria, she said, well, my father can speak German to you, and she took me up to her apartment, and he met her family. And we became friends, but we were, as I say, not the same type. But nevertheless, we did gossip and we did hopscotch and all kind of little games which you do in the street. And we were friends for 2 years. And in the meantime, of course, after the German occupied Holland, it was not like Germany or Austria, that the population was against us. It was really only the occupation, the Nazis. And so they wanted to keep the Dutch as friends. So they didn't take the measures against the Jewish population immediately. So it looked first as if nothing was going to happen. But very slowly, the measures against Jewish people started to come up. And
did you experience any of those?
Oh, yes, of course. But at first, perhaps the first year, it was disagreeable. It was a nuisance, but it was not life-threatening. So we were not allowed on public transport. We were not go to cinemas or swimming pools or any sport activities. So they tried to try us to isolate us from the ordinary population. I remember at the time the film, the first Walt Disney film, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, came out, and all the non-Jewish children, that was all they talked about, because it was an amazing thing. And we Jewish children couldn't go and see the film. So this kind of thing, you know, we felt, and quite childish thinking back of it. But that is what children, and as I say, I loved swimming and things. I couldn't go to the swimming pools and things like that. But then slowly things became more difficult. Like we had to wear a yellow star. So it meant that walking in the street, we were recognizable as different. And so it arrested people. People disappeared. And then we had to leave our school and go into Jewish schools, which was by itself not bad, because now a lot of Jewish people want the children to go to Jewish school. But it was a danger, because the Germans knew there were Jewish children there which they wanted to catch. And so they went with trucks to the schools and went into classroom, told the children to go on a truck. And in the evening, the parents waited for the children to come home, and they never turned up. And they went to the police and went to the Nazi headquarters to inquire where were the children. And nobody gave them information. And they were never, ever heard of again. And only after the war did one hear they were sent to Mauthausen, a horrific Austrian death camp, and they were just murdered there. And as well, people were picked up in the street and disappeared, and so it became really dangerous to do anything. So that was really, so that was from 1941 to 1942, we were really scared. So every evening when we were still at home as a family, we were sort of relieved.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking with Eva Schloss. She's a Holocaust survivor, and she's the keynote speaker at Viterbo University's Teaching the Holocaust workshop. So eventually, your family made the decision to split up and go into hiding?
Well, that was through another incident. One morning, about 10,000 young people got a call-up notice to go to Germany to work in German factories. That was my brother Heinz, who was 16, and as well Anna's sister Margot, and many, many, many of their friends and older people, till about 25. And that was a time when our parents decided they wouldn't send their children, but we would go into hiding. So it had a reason why we took this exact time. And when my father took us together and said, I have to talk to you seriously, we have to disappear, we have to go into hiding, I didn't get that, you know. But my father explained to us that we had to split up again. Mm-hmm. I will go with my mother and Heinz will go with him. And I didn't want to, you know, I objected. And he said, well, doing this splitting up, we have more chance that at least one part of the family would survive. And that shocked me, to speak of survival, because then I realized it is really a matter of life and death.
So you and your mother, you moved around to different hiding spots, mm-hmm. correct?
Well, we all had to, sure. Because the Germans knew that not the 10,000 people had come, so they knew about 5,000 had gone into hiding, and they really wanted to catch every Jew. It is amazing how much effort they made, how much valuable war time they spent in chasing the Jews, transporting them, building their death camps, killing them. It was a really an enormous war effort, really, which they used to destroy the Jewish people.
And ultimately, you and your mother were betrayed, and on your 15th birthday,
all four of us were betrayed by a Dutch nurse who really was a double agent, who really worked for the Nazis but pretended she was a member of the resistance. And on my 15th birthday, we were arrested, and that was on a Tuesday, and on Friday, we were already on transport eastward.
And where were they? Can you talk about that then? Just that moment, can you remember being caught and being transported?
Yeah, well, you know, it's amazing. I remember everything very, very clearly as if it happened yesterday.
Yeah.
We were in this camp in Westerbork, in the north of Holland, and on Friday morning we were called up and taken on transport. And, well, Holland was the most Western country, and we knew going towards the east is certain death. We knew about the many death camps. The BBC then broadcast out to all the occupied countries in their own language. And they told, of course, the progress of the war, but as well they always mentioned the concentration camp and death camps, 300 of them in Germany and Poland, where Jewish people were systematically being gassed. And Auschwitz was always mentioned. Of course, when we went on transport, we didn't know where we were going. So they never talked to us for, you know, we were really just cattle being transported in cattle trucks. And that was a horrible journey, as you can imagine, about 80 people in one wagon, which was really a goods train or for the cattle. Just a little slit of air and nothing in it. We had to stand most of the time, 3-4 days traveling. Once a day, the doors were pulled open and bread was thrown in like you would feed wild animals.
Did people talk to one another? I mean, or would you pray?
There was some talk, of course, speculating what was going to happen and so on. And that was really the last proper conversation I had with my father and my brother. My father, with tears in his eyes, apologized that from now on he can't protect us anymore. I think that was for him, being such a wonderful family man, the worst, that he was powerless to look after his family anymore. And my brother, so he was a musician. He, with 4 years old, he started already to play piano. Mm-hmm. And he really was a very, very talented musician, but he obviously had other talents. And in hiding, he was cooped up in a tiny little room, was not even allowed to look out of the window. And he couldn't play any music, so he started to paint, and he created some amazing paintings. And in the cattle truck, the last conversation I had with him, he told me that before they escaped from the woman who blackmailed them, he hid the paintings under the floorboards with a notice on it. This belonged to Heinz and Erich Geiringer, and after the war, he's going to come and pick it up again. He told me that.
Did you ever find those paintings?
Yes, I did.
Wow. That must just be one of your most prized possessions, I would assume.
Yeah, well, it is.
And they were donated.
I donated them.
Oh, really?
About, it's now about 8 years ago, to the Resistance Museum in Amsterdam, because there were 30... it's really artworks, you know. And I thought, when I'm not around anymore, my family will take one or two, but as a collection, they should be really seen by many people.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Eva Schloss. She's a survivor of the Holocaust, and she's the keynote speaker at this year's Teaching the Holocaust workshop through Viterbo University, which is celebrating its 10th anniversary. So eventually the trains, I don't know how many stops it made, but eventually your family ended up at Auschwitz.
Correct. And that was, of course, which we know, the biggest death camp. So, in Auschwitz at least, it sounds controversial, there was a selection. So not everybody was killed at arrival. But there were, of course, other camps like Treblinka, where there was no selection. Every transport, there was a beautiful station with flower baskets, and then there was a long covered pass, where people were herded in straight to the gas chambers. So everybody who arrived there was immediately guest. So you have no chance anymore. In Auschwitz, there was a selection, so some people had a chance perhaps to make it. So eventually we were all supposed to be killed.
And they split up your mother, or you and your mother, from your father and your brother.
Men and women were separated immediately. Auschwitz, that is a name which is a camp known, but there were actually many, many camps there. And the women camp was called Birkenau. Mm-hmm. And that's where the women went.
Did you have to work when you were there?
Of course.
What was your job? What was your mother's job?
Well, every morning the Nazis came and there was a roll call. We stood in front of the barracks and they picked people for different work commandos. And it was always physically very, very hard labor from morning early to late at night. And one of the worst jobs was in the women camps, latrines, toilets, were just horrendous. They were just holes in a cement construction, and it didn't go anywhere. And it had to be emptied out with little mugs and carried somewhere and buried in the earth somewhere. And that was, of course, the most horrendous job, as you can imagine, because it was full of bacteria and smell, and there was no possibility to wash afterwards. So the stench and the, it was just awful. And of course, everybody avoided to do this job, but nevertheless, I had often to do this. And this was really horrendous.
Were you in constant fear every day living there and working
there? We lived really from day to day. We had to really, in the morning when you get up, try to get through this day. We didn't think any further. Food, of course, was non-existing. We got in the morning a little mug of some liquid, and in the evening a chunk of bread. Well, how long can you survive on that?
And I think I read, too, that you and your mother learned to find the carrot scraps, too.
Yeah.
And survive off
of
that.
Well, we had all kind of little ideas of how to get some extra vitamins or food.
Sure.
Or that. So they had, of course, a kitchen where they cooked as well for the Nazis, because there were many, many Nazis guarding those camps. And so the end of the carrots with a little bit of green, it was on a rubbish heap. We went to pick this up, and we swapped it for sometimes a little bit of bread or something. And when they were in a good mood, they called some of us, and the water where they cooked the potatoes, they gave us. Mm. And that was the most delicious food we had ever had.
What else do you think it was that did help you and your mother to survive?
Well, a lot of it was luck. My mother met her cousin, who really saved us. And partly that we were together for a while, but not all the time. And, I was a very stubborn child. I'm a Taurus. I went really with my head through the wall. And I really wanted to live. And, I was 15, and I hadn't really lived. And I had... as I say, we had a wonderful life in Austria, and I really wanted to experience that. I wanted to have a family. That was for me very important. First, I wanted to have a boyfriend, wanted to get married, wanted to have a family. And with my stubbornness, I wasn't very willing to give that up. And I really, as I said, I lived from day to day hoping that the end would come and I would still be around.
Why do you think it's important for people now, today, to remember and know what happened to you and millions of others?
Well, yes, it's important to learn about this terrible period, and it is important, but you have to learn a bit of the history, how it was possible that a man like Hitler, who was a completely uneducated Austrian, how he was able to get to power. So really, teaching the Holocaust, you have to go back to the First World War. It was a big mistake of the Allied to put such terrible conditions on a country which had lost the war. And that's why it was possible for Hitler to be able to get to power, because Germany was really desperate. There was starvation, there was an enormous inflation. People had to go with a wheelbarrow of paper money to buy a loaf of bread. Millions of mark was $1, and it changed every day. The mark was worth less and less, and there was really starvation, unemployment, and many governments tried to improve the Weimar Republic, and nobody succeeded. And then came this nobody and said he has a way out, and people said, well, we are not losing anything, let him try. And he succeeded at first. And what was, of course, very important to realize as well, that when a country is so poor, communism had started in Russia in 1918, and it had spread to Germany, where, if people are poor, communism becomes powerful. And Hitler was fighting the communists. And that was a great mistake of the Western world. Everybody was more afraid of the communists than of Hitler. And they said, well, let this man fight the communists. And Churchill was really the only person who realized the danger of National Socialism and of Hitler. But the world didn't want to know.
So it's learning from the past mistakes and making sure they never happen again.
Exactly. It's very important to learn history, what had happened, and what mistakes the Western world have made.
Eva Schloss is a Holocaust survivor and the keynote speaker at Viterbo University's Teaching the Holocaust workshop. Visit WPR.org/newsmakers for an extended interview with Eva Schloss, where she talks more about her time in Auschwitz and about life after she was liberated. You're listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up next, learn about the Campaign to Change Direction, a new initiative that promotes mental well-being in the workplace. To hear this and other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. La Crosse is one of the first communities to participate in a new national movement that promotes mental well-being. It's called the Campaign to Change Direction and involves dozens of La Crosse companies educating their workers on how to recognize when a friend or coworker needs help. Teresa Pulvermacher is the Director of Operations and Programming at La Crosse's Riverside Corporate Wellness. She explains what the Campaign to Change Direction is all about.
The Campaign to Change Direction is an awareness movement that really is designed to change the way we think and talk about mental wellness. There are really three driving forces behind the movement. One of them, and I think probably the most important, is recognizing that each of us has the capacity to recognize suffering in one another. And it encourages us to call upon our strength and our compassion to talk to one another when we recognize that there's something wrong. And that's the five signs of suffering. And they're really very, very basic. There are things like recognizing when someone isn't taking care of themselves the way they're supposed to, or not eating the way they're supposed to, things that you would notice. But the idea is that typically we don't talk to each other about things like that because we're afraid of the response that we're going to get. But that's part of the culture that we want to change, because mental wellness is really important. We all exist on a continuum of mental wellness. Some days we're in a really good place and we're really happy, and other days, you know, we can be in a really dark place. But if you're able to recognize in your coworker or your friend or your loved one that something's not quite right, and you have overcome your fear of talking to them about that, it has great potential to prevent long-range problems, you know, and getting into the point where it is no longer mental wellness, where it becomes mental illness, or at the worst extreme, someone would commit suicide. So the five signs is really a way for all of us to change our lexicon about the way we talk about mental wellness. Ultimately, I think the goal is to eliminate the stigma associated with mental illness and to prevent people from getting to mental illness, to approach mental wellness like we approach a heart attack. Or if I say to you, stop, drop, and roll, you know that you're on fire. But I don't think people are willing at this point to talk about mental illness and mental wellness like that. And the ultimate goal of the change direction is to change the way we talk about mental wellness.
Should we go over the five signs? You talked about the issue of hygiene and cleanliness, and that's one of the five signs. And there's four more. And you have this beautiful little list and these signs that people might start noticing around town hanging up that point out the five signs.
Okay, one of the signs is personality change. You know, a person may become more withdrawn. They may become more agitated. That's another one of the signs. Personality changes, you know, you might have someone that's typically been a very happy person, all of a sudden seems very sad, doesn't want to go in social situations, may have a difficult time getting to work. One of the other signs is withdrawal, and I already mentioned that, you know, they don't want to participate in the things that they typically participate in. Poor self-care, like you mentioned, hygiene, coming to work in dirty clothes, coming to work in clothes that they wore yesterday, you know, things that you would notice in a coworker, and that you may or may not feel comfortable addressing. But in time, we might get to that point where you'll say, you know, I noticed that there's something that's bothering you. The other thing is a sense of hopelessness, and I don't know how best to describe this because I think everybody probably expresses hopelessness in different ways. But I think that if you are sincere and you truly want to change the culture, if I were to come up to you and say, you know, I noticed that, you know, you're wearing the same clothes that you wore yesterday, or you seem really sad, or, you know, any one of these five signs. If it were you just having a bad day, what I've done is just shown you that I care. You know, I'm not saying that I think that you're mentally ill. I'm just saying I care about you. And that, in my opinion, is one of the most important things that the five signs of suffering, or even the whole campaign to change direction, can do for us as a society, is get us to recognize that we can talk to one another.
Like, let's say I noticed it in a coworker and I did approach them about it. Do I need any special sort of training? Do I need to tread lightly? I mean, I know all these issues can be so individualistic too, that what's the best way to approach it if you do notice something?
Well, that's the one thing that's been really interesting in our community. And when we came together and told them about what we wanted to do, like, we started with 13 organizations, and now we have 52 organizations who really are the experts in mental wellness and mental illness in prevention and in treatment. And these organizations are phenomenal. We have the resources for people that come upon someone that has expressed a concern about their mental well-being, but people really don't know how to address all of these services, or to access them, rather. And many of them are free, most of them are free, public service. I think one of our goals as an organization is an awareness piece that all of these organizations exist. And La Crosse was quite remarkable, you know, in starting with this small group and all of these people coming together saying, we have this, and our goal wasn't to reinvent the wheel. It's to pull all of these organizations together so that when you recognize that your friend or your coworker or a loved one has an issue, you know where to go, because the community has come together and given you a storehouse or a wealth of information, a wealth of resources that you can get that person help when they need it. And what our group decided was that we have a wonderful service in the statewide service of Great Rivers 211, and they have an excellent resource in mental crisis. a mental crisis help hotline. And they have been doing great work, and the community recognizes that they've been doing great work, that they have resources readily available. So we hope in time to strengthen Great Rivers 211, and all these organizations are saying that they would like to help do that too, because it's such an easy place. So if you recognize that someone's suffering, let's call 211. Let's find out what we can do. And if the community has come together and put all their resources in one place, God, that's a very easy solution.
So would Great Rivers 211 almost be the go-to place if someone's recognizing this, either in a coworker or even themselves, because I'm assuming that a lot of this will create self-awareness within people too?
I think that's a good way to put it.
Okay.
There are lots and lots of organizations, and the county, for example, has wonderful lists of resources and has great pamphlets and documentation. But when you are talking with someone who has a mental wellness concern, it's an emotional setting. I mean, how many of us really can pull our thoughts together quickly and get resources for someone that is in a crisis? And that's why we think 211 probably is a really good solution to that, because you call 211 and they're going to be able to talk to you about what's going on and decide which resource is probably one of the better ones for you to go to. It's just a great go-to. But that said, there are great organizations within the community that are ready, willing, and able to help. Great Rivers 211 is just an amazing storehouse of all of those organizations.
The sense that I got this morning in just listening to people is that, you have almost like the core structure. Start acknowledging the fact that mental wellness is extremely important personally and in the workplace. But it seems very fluid as far as how this campaign can evolve over time. And there seem to be a lot of ideas and just people wondering, what does this mean in a year?
I think that it's very simple. What the campaign to change direction really wants us to do, the very minimal ask, is that you take these five signs and you post them somewhere and you get people to just be aware that they are capable of recognizing mental suffering in each other. That's the very, very basic thing. I think La Crosse has taken it up a notch, and I would venture a guess that in other communities that maybe are not like La Crosse, that aren't quite as developed as we are in our mental wellness resources, that this is a really awesome place to start. I mean, getting people to be aware that mental wellness is important, that we all exist on that continuum, that we shouldn't be afraid to talk to one another about mental wellness, that it's a great way to prevent mental illness. I mean, that's the driving force behind all of this. Just recognize that this is an important part of your well-being, and it's something that we should all talk about. And if we were to talk about it like we talk about heart attacks or strokes, we can really make a difference. And in the United States as a whole, there is such a shortage of behavioral health providers. And if we can find ways to prevent people from sliding to the other side of the continuum where we're treating mental illness, I think we've done a great service.
Given all the community partners that are involved just in the La Crosse area, how do you envision that this could make a difference in our community, 1 to 5 years out, in hopes that the campaign change direction, that it continues going and the momentum remains?
Well, I think the campaign as a whole has some very long-range goals. And mental illness and the stigma associated with mental illness and seeking help for mental illness is really culturally ingrained. And I wish I could say that in a year's time, everybody's going to be aware and the five signs are going to be everywhere and the school kids are going to be talking about it and nobody's going to bully each other anymore and we're all going to be more compassionate. But I don't see that happening. But I see in a year's time that this community will come together and they will have fine-tuned the resources that we have in a storehouse where we can really start pushing the five signs out in a different way. Because I think there was great fear when we started. Well, okay, you put these five signs out there and we get everybody to recognize signs of emotional distress in one another, then what are we going to do? So I think in 5 years, we will have made great strides in getting people to recognize the five signs, and we'll have good resources in place. But I think as far as the culture goes and the stigma associated with mental illness, I don't think it's going to disappear quickly, but we certainly are determined with this awareness effort to at least get the ball rolling.
Teresa Pulvermacher is the Director of Operations and Programming at La Crosse's Riverside Corporate Wellness. She was talking about the Campaign to Change Direction, a new national movement to promote mental well-being. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. There are dozens of La Crosse businesses that are educating their workers on how to recognize potential mental issues in friends and coworkers. La Crosse-based Logistics Health Incorporated is among that group, as it's a founding member of the national Campaign to Change Direction. LHI founder and CEO Don Weber talks about why it's so involved in the effort.
As a business person, you're always looking at ways to improve your profitability and to stay competitive, and particularly with the competitiveness of the contracts that we have to bid on. And, you know, I've always believed that I've been blessed because of the people I've been able to surround myself with, and that the greatest value any organization, you know, or to any organization are its employees and their families. I always include the families. And we as employers always, you know, think about investing in all the things that, you know, are necessary to build and grow and manage businesses, your facilities and your technology. And we often talk about, you know, oh, we know how important our employees are, but I think a lot of times they're empty words when really the greatest investment we should make are in our employees and their families.
And you talked about how, you know, you're trying to make the greatest employees, and I know here at LHI there's a workout facility. And I know other workplaces in the area do that too, but do you think that mental health wellness almost has a lesser priority than the physical well-being?
Well, I think that, you know, there's a stigma about mental health. And, you know, I mean, we have people here who, you know, are being treated for cancer. We have people who are working on obesity problems, and people who have high blood pressure and high cholesterol. I've been involved in some of those situations myself, and no one looks at it as a stigma. But, oh, behavioral health? You know, there's something really wrong with that person. When one in five of us suffer from some form of behavioral challenges. And so if I look at my employee base here, you know, you have 1,100 employees here, and you go, one in five? And why should they be treated differently than someone who's being treated for cancer or looked at differently? And so as we develop this wellness culture, and it's not just about a fitness center. I mean, it's so much more than that. And having primary care available. And all the ancillary services that go along with that. I mean, because we have 70% of our employee base are female, and 80% are under 40, we have a lot of babies. Love it. You know, we had 38 babies last year. And, you know, up until a couple of years ago, you know, we talked about the behavioral resources that maybe we should be providing. And one of the discussion points was, well, the stigma. Would employees really use it? Because who wants to be seen having a session with a behavioral specialist? You know, the room is way down the hallway, you know, the dark hallway. So we said, no, we're gonna handle it like any other ancillary service that we provide here. And we started it out, and you know, educating people is very important. I mean, it's a big part of our whole wellness culture, understanding what it's all about, how to use the services, how to, what is primary care really all about. So we do a lot of that. So we brought on a behavioral health specialist, and it really was surprising. It was booked all the time. And then we brought a second one on. And, you know, you have to understand that, you know, things change during our lifetime. And I've always said, you know, we all have stress in our lives. And when an employee comes here to work, I don't want to add more stress. I want them to go home at the end of the day with less stress in their life. And you know, I've been there myself. I mean, you know, all of a sudden we have some real financial challenges in our life. I've lost my own home at one point in time. I know how devastating that can be to someone, or someone loses a loved one, you know. So there's a lot of reasons why, you know, these things add a burden, and that stress can deteriorate and work on you, and you become not as productive. And we always have believed that, you know, a healthy employee is a productive employee. Well, that's also with their families. And so it was amazing. I mean, I have letters and cards from employees and their family members, how it's changed their life, literally, you know.
I mean, having the behavioral health.
Yes. I mean, here's a card I got from a 15-year-old girl who I had never met. And, you know, she goes, "Dear Don, I just wanted to say thank you for helping me through my treatment. It means a lot to me and my family. If it wasn't for the help, my addiction could have gotten so much worse than which it was already at. It may have saved my life. I am very grateful I got my life back, my mom's trust, and my friends back again, and it is the best feeling to know how amazing people are." This is a 15-year-old girl from one of our employees who I found out was coming in twice a week for sessions.
To the LHI facilities?
Yes. It's turned that person's life around. Well, don't you think that has taken so much stress off that mother and as an employee, and her loyalty and dedication? That's, to me, is what it's all about. So why would we not support this? So, I mean, behavioral is a huge issue in this country. It truly is. Not everybody has to go in and needs the kind of treatment and needs medication. I'm not saying that. But people need resources. And they find out, you know, in having conversations. Look, sometimes, you know, we have issues and that come up in our lifetime, and we can go home and discuss these things with our spouses or with our best friends. And, you know, we work through them. And other times you need somebody totally independent, a third party. And having that resource available, you know, to give direction really, really helps. And the investment to us as a company is so worth it. There's no question about it. When we look at the return of what we get back as an organization, and these services are provided free of charge. You know, our employees don't pay for these services. They're there to help them. But on the bottom line, I think it's the greatest return we get as a corporation.
So as you're starting to think more about mental health well-being and the role that plays in your company, from what I understand, within this campaign to change direction, you're engaging other local employers and maybe faith-based groups and medical facilities, just to talk about this. Can you talk about this collaboration, not only on the local level, but also on the national level?
Well, you know, really what happened was, I mean, there was nothing intentional here that we're going to, you know, go out and nationally try to raise, you know, awareness to these problems. Because of what we were doing here, Barbara Van Dalen, who we've worked with her organization in the past, Given Hour, which she has thousands of behavioral health specialists, who she asked, "Hey, can you give an hour of your time once a week or whenever possible to help one of our veterans out there who needs support? And because we provide these services to our veterans, you know, we were able to work together and our resources, you know, complemented one another. And we got to know each other, and she got to really understand about this whole culture we had here as a company and as an organization. And it's basically trying to make people aware, I believe, of a couple of things. Number one, the stigma. You know, let's get over that. And number two is you know, there's five things to you know, observe that are signs that someone is maybe having some challenges in their life.
Don Weber is founder and CEO of La Crosse-based Logistics Health Incorporated and one of the businesses spearheading the campaign to change direction. It's a national movement to promote mental well-being in the workplace. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show and to find other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. There, you'll also find a link to the campaign to change direction. If you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff, that and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and photos, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.